collaboration with Daniel, Ofeg and Badri. And Daniel's name is in bold because he did all the work, him being the graduate student. He might be visiting Perimeter for a week in May if you want to talk to him. The presentation is based on these two papers of us, and all the codes used to produce the calculations are publicly available under this DOI. If you think about how a binary black hole merger looks like, then you might know this picture from 25 years ago, the famous pair of pants picture, which shows the event horizon. So you have the two individual horizons at the bottom, and they finally merge and form the common event horizon at the top. And the top is then, this is a head-on collision, so it's a Schwarzschild black hole that is stationary. And the disadvantage of event horizons is that they are not causal. An event horizon exists at a particular time because of something that will happen in the future, not because of something that has happened in the past. I don't want to dis event horizons here. They're very, very useful to understand the global structure of a spacetime, but they can't be used to make any causal statement. So if you say, this is the current state, I want to predict what happens in the future, in the sense of an initial value problems for a PDE with evolution equations, this has nothing to do with event horizons. You can only calculate event horizons if you know the complete future of the spacetime, or if you assume that your spacetime is stationary, of course, then you also know the future. And as an example, you can have event horizons that are created in a Minkowski region of spacetime. So the famous example, if our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy were to merge in a million years and form a gigantic black hole, which they probably won't, then there could be an event horizon in this room right now, and we would not notice. The event horizon would be a null surface, it would cross the room with the speed of light, and we would not notice. And this makes them not usable to understand highly dynamic black hole spacetimes, and you need to use something else for that. And I'm going to use marginally outer trapped surfaces for that. It's a bit of a mouthful, in particular if you give a talk. So I'm going to call them MOTS. It's also a nice word. If you've ever been in Berlin, there's a newspaper distributed by homeless people that's called MOTS, because MOTSEN means to complain. It's very colloquial in German. It has nothing to do with that. And if you do numerical calculation, you might call these MOTS horizons or apparent horizons in kind of an informal language. But it's a bit unfortunate because there's a bit of confusion of terminology. So I'll try to do the right thing and always call them MOTS and not apparent horizons. I don't want to go into too much detail describing what a MOTS actually is, but you might know trapped surfaces. So the thing is, you have a geometry, and in this spacetime, you take a two-surface, a surface with S2 topology, and on that two-surface, you calculate a particular kind of curvature, which is called the expansion. Loosely speaking, you take an area element of the surface and shoot light rays outwards and shoot and look whether this area element grows or shrinks. So if you have a sphere in Minkowski and shoot light rays outwards, the sphere is going to expand, so that is going to grow. And if that expansion is zero everywhere on the surface, then it's a marginally outer trapped surface. And the outermost marginally outer trapped surface that can be nested like Russian dolls would be called the apparent horizons. And there are a set of secondary conditions that also need to be true that I'm going to skip over here in this talk, but I'm all too happy to discuss them in great detail on the blackboard if you're actually interested in that. Now, different from the event horizons, a MOTS is defined locally in time. That is, you can choose one particular hypersurface, one instant in time, and then find out where these MOTS are in there, where the horizons are in there, and how many there are. And this can be used to reliably detect black holes as a calculation proceeds. And it has been known, although that was not known initially, that these MOTS actually form smooth whirled tubes, like an event horizon. You find them instantaneously in time, and then you stack all these MOTS together, and then you get a smooth whirl tube that evolves in time. And this whirl tube is null, a null surface like an event horizon. If there's nothing happening, if no radiation or matter is falling in, that's also called an isolated horizon. And if there's gravitational radiation falling in or matter falling in, then the surface grows, and then it can in general be space-like, the surface. I mean, it then grows superluminally, and that would be called a dynamical horizon. And these MOTS, these isolated and dynamical horizons, they satisfy black hole thermodynamic laws in the very same way that event horizons do. And you can have area and flux balance laws for these horizons. You calculate how much matter, how much gravitational radiation, angular momentum is falling in, and you can get the detailed balance law. You look at the initial angular momentum, the later one, find out how much falls in, and it all works out nicely. It is quite convenient.
Eric?
Yes?
Reliably detect could mean two things. One is that the things that are detected are always black holes, and the other is whether all black holes are detected by this
material. I mean the second one, because there was a bit of confusion in the community, depending on how you define what a MOTS is, what secondary conditions you have, that there was a fear that you could have black holes space times where there are no apparent horizons. And then people were afraid that you do these numerical calculations and suddenly you hit a singularity and you never know anything because these apparent horizons don't work. And that was based on rather stringent conditions and people relaxed the condition, what it actually means, what a MOTS is. And then I don't have a proof that it always exists, but at least numerically there's strong evidence. And in the Schwarzschild case time, you can actually prove it, that you always have a MOTS if you have a black hole and if you encounter a singularity. Good. So this is how a binary black hole collision works. I'm going to show you a series of snapshots. So it's done in axis symmetry because we wanted to reduce the cost of the simulations because these required quite a bit of resolution, much more than you usually have when you're just interested in gravitational radiation further out. There are two black holes merging, and here they have a mass ratio of 1:4. And this is perimeter. Going to use a hockey stick, of course. So this is the small black hole, mass 1, well, 0.2. This is the big individual black hole, and they start a bit further apart, and they fall towards each other along the z-axis. And at this instant, a common apparent horizon has formed. That's the pear-shaped blue line around here. So you see, when the apparent horizon forms, it does not start smoothly from the existing previously apparent horizons. It just appears at that instant, and you find it, and it has a larger mass or area. And then if you go forward in time, you actually see that these MOTS are formed in pairs. You not get just a single one, you get an outer one, that's the blue surface, and that's actually the apparent horizon in this spacetime. But you also get a green one, and the green one is shrinking and moving inwards. And if you're interested in the trapped region, you might have trapped region inside these black holes, depending on your initial conditions, what you put in there, whether you put a singularity in there or a puncture or something. But there's also a trapped region here between the blue and the green one. And this region here is actually, well, I don't know whether it's trapped or untrapped. I shouldn't make a statement about that. And then as you go further in time, you see that the apparent horizon, the blue surface grows and it becomes circular and it forms a curved black hole and everything interesting, but the green surface actually shrinks and gets closer to the individual horizons. And this is actually the brand new result. I mean, this one was known before from other binary black hole simulations that people have been doing for, I don't know, 10, 15 years or something. But it's very difficult to track these inner common apparent horizon, the blue surface. And that's now something new. So before, people did not know where the trapped regions are inside a binary black hole systems and how the system actually goes forward and evolves. Now we were able, and that's Daniel's work, to track this inner surface. They get closer to each other and even closer to each other. Now it looks like an apple. They almost overlap. And here's it's a different calculation now, how it looks like. You see, this is the previous picture. And here you still see all three horizons, except the blue one is on this image, on top of the other one, because it actually nicely goes together. And here it's zoomed in by a factor of 100. And you see how this green surface develops a neck that is almost cut off. And then at a later time, that here in this calculation, the green surface vanishes, and you only have the two individual horizons, individual MOTS, that actually intersect. That is also something that was much more difficult to see early on. Yes?
So Eric, can I understand the physical significance of the inner and outer MOTS as saying something about where I'm allowed to go inside of the black hole in some sense? Like if I'm inside the green MOTS, does that mean that I could not go through it?
It's difficult because if you look at the whirl tubes of the green and the blue MOTS, they are both space-like. So the green one is kind of shrinking faster than the speed of light. So you might say if you're here close to the green surface, then you can traverse here, but you can't go back because it's, well, shrinking superluminally. Actually, the green surface becomes a bit time-like later on in certain places, so I take back what I just said. But it's true for the blue surface, which grows and which space-like everywhere. So this is something, a surface that is smaller than the event horizon. We haven't looked for the event horizon here, but it's probably something spherical that's a bit outside of the green one. It has probably that shape here as well. and this blue surface is moving outwards superluminally. And it's not quite clear to me where the trap region is, because we only looked at the spacetime in one particular slicing foliation. And if you choose a different foliation, then the green and the blue surfaces might have a slightly different shape. Probably not very different, but it could be that the trap region is actually larger than the green surface. But if you're thinking about where to go and where not to go, then you probably want to look at where the null geodesics are. And that's a question that you can answer via event horizons. It's more difficult to answer that via trap regions and trap surfaces. And, yes?
I'm confused about that. The blue surface, you say, might not be a trapped surface? I thought that's
no, the blue and all the surfaces shown here are marginally trapped surfaces.
So doesn't that mean it should be inside of the event horizon?
Yes, it's inside the event horizon. I assume the event horizon is approximately this shape here, because this is a late time, so it's probably stationary here. But I don't know exactly whether the region here in the middle is also trapped. So if you have something collapsing in spherical symmetry and you're right in the center, then for reasons of symmetry, that point is actually untrapped until you hit the singularities. There could be something untrapped here. That's a general feature that kind of the trapped region forms outside and then moves inwards. So you're kind of trapped inside the black hole already in the event horizon, but you're not yet in a trapped region.
You're talking about some kind of secondary trapping. I mean, you're already trapped in.
Yeah, no, this is more, I wouldn't call it trapping, but it's more of a global geometric thing that happens here.
In your simulation, are you putting singularities in the middle of the circles?
We start with using puncture black holes, so there's no singularity. And then as we evolve, we treat this to the punctures numerically, we add a bit of dissipation there. So there's in the very center of these individual horizons, we do not evolve the Einstein equations, we do something else. But we know how information flows, and we know that the rest of the simulation is not affected by this. It's just a numerical trick, because we don't want to handle the infinities there. And you could set up other initial conditions where you have a singularity right there, right away. It's just that historically, these are routines you can just get and download, and then you have easy ways of setting up black holes. I'd find it more interesting to superpose two curl black holes and do something there, but it's not relevant for this work. Now, I want to briefly describe the technical background that made it possible to look for these highly distorted surfaces. So one way people look for horizon is that you describe the surface of the horizon as a scalar function depending on two angles, say the radius as function of theta and phi. Well, here only of one angle, of course. So this is the origin, and then you have the green surface you want to represent, and then you just, in each radial direction for each angle, you look at the radius, you look at how far the surface is away from the origin. And if the surface is approximately spherical or elliptic, it's clear that that works out. But here it doesn't work anymore, because you see there's these points here bunch up and you don't need the resolution there. And here the points are really far apart. And then that means you need to increase the resolution. It's quite inconvenient. And if the surface has a shape that's even more hourglass shaped, it doesn't work anymore. You can ignore the blue line here. And that was Daniel's idea, that instead of starting from the origin, you start from a reference surface. Here the blue surface, which you choose, this is slightly elliptic, not quite spherical. And then you define your radial direction as going inwards from this reference surface. You see these radial lines, they don't actually end up at the origin anymore, but now the points are nicely evenly distributed along that black hole. And this change in representation of the MODS surface, this change in algorithm, makes it possible to find these highly distorted horizons that was not possible before. So that's also this technological improvement that made it possible to understand the interior of a binary black hole system. Now, the general picture that you have is this sketch then. So time goes to the right, and the area of the surfaces goes up. And you can also think of this something. It's roughly the coordinate radius. You have, this is the sum of the individual areas of the individual horizons, which slowly grow, and they grow, and they grow. And at some point, it meets this, the apparent horizon appears. That's the blue surface, grows very quickly, infinitely fast initially, grows more and more slowly, and forms a curved horizon at some point. And then you have this blue surface, this inner horizon that shrinks and shrinks, and that actually meets the red surfaces. You saw how the two horizons merge and the green surfaces hugs these other surfaces more and more. And this is what I would say is the major contribution of our paper, actually showing that these surfaces merge. And it's a numerical work, so it's very difficult to make a statement like two things are identical numerically. So I'm going to show a few graphs to see that they actually merge. We studied a few quantities. So for example, these are the masses, the sum of the masses of the individual horizon and the green surface. When you see them meet, that's actually zoomed in here at exactly the point where they meet. We can't find the green surface, but if you extrapolate here, you see that it actually meets quite nicely. And here on a log scale, various distance method measurements, for example, the distance between the two individual horizons goes to zero here, well, minus infinity on the log scale. So this would be the time where they merge. Then we look at the circumference of the neck that forms of that green horizon, and you see it goes to zero. It's exactly the same time. Well, if you draw it on a linear scale, you see that the curves actually meet, but more difficult to see here.
Can I challenge you, Clint, yes, that they meet in that bottom left plot, and that clearly you could continue to draw the green line in a smooth way where it would miss the red.
It would, yes, but actually, yeah. This morning we had a telecon. I did not want to update the slides, but we have much better data where it actually does meet here. By eye. And we also look at various distance measured, for example, the distance between the green and one of the individual horizons in various geodesic directions, for example, the Z direction or in the X direction. And all these distances go to zero, and I really should have used the linear plot here, and they all seem to merge at the same time. So, but yes, challenge that, because this is the main point, and it's really difficult to make that statement numerically. So if something is wrong with the paper, then but I'd be surprised if we looked at that and then we have find horizons to 8 digits and so on and things seems to work out. But it's still numerically, it's not a proof.
Yeah, I think actually the right-hand plot is more convincing than the left-hand plot.
Yes, yes. And another point I want to make is that these horizon world tubes are actually smooth. If you do a numerical calculation of binary black holes, then you might be used to the fact that these mods actually form smooth weld tubes. But initially, people did not believe that because you find these horizons only at instances in time, and that just might be jagged, right? If you put things on top of each other like a Jenga tower, it would not be smooth. And in the meantime, luckily, there's a mathematical condition that is necessary for the weld tube to be smooth. That means a certain operator needs to be invertible, and we can evaluate the eigenvalues of this operator numerically, and then we show that no eigenvalue is zero. So here we look at the lowest eigenvalue, which also happens to be a real eigenvalue, and we show that it is zero almost at every time. It's not zero here at that point. Sorry, it is zero here, which is the time where the two horizons actually form, which is, in that plot here, is at this point. But if you go later in time, this operator actually is invertible. That is a bit difficult to explain the graph. So this is the stability parameter, which is the lowest eigenvalue, which is real. And this is the distance between black holes. And here we just examine initial conditions where you can black holes there. And we consider various mass ratios. Let's look, for example, at the red curve here, which is a mass ratio of 1 to 2. Then this branch here corresponds to the common apparent horizon that grows. And this branch here corresponds to the inner horizon, inner mods, that actually shrinks. And of course, you see that the stability parameter is actually negative, which surprised us in the beginning. I should probably tell a bit of a story about that here. But then we look at the second lowest eigenvalue, and the second lowest eigenvalue is positive in all these cases. So the operator is not elliptic anymore, but it's still invertible, and that is sufficient to show that the world tube is actually smooth. That doesn't show global smoothness, but locally, every time we find the horizon, we know it's part of a smooth world tube. And then it kind of makes sense that altogether the world tube is actually also smooth. Then I want to briefly mention the Penrose inequality. That's a geometric inequality that relates the sum of the areas of the apparent horizons and the ADM mass. So A is the sum of the masses of the horizons, as in this picture, this figure here. And this is the how you would convert the ADM mass to an area. And it says that the areas of the apparent horizon is always smaller than the ADM mass. And that means, essentially, it has to do with the positivity of the gravitational radiation, that it has a positive energy, and so on. Now, this is for the areas. You can write a corresponding statement for the masses of the apparent horizons. And if you have two apparent horizons in a spacetime, then their mass is typically larger than the ADM mass of the spacetime. So the ADM mass is the total mass. And the reason is that there's a binding energy, which is negative. And then the negative binding energy plus the positive gravitational wave energy plus the large individual horizon masses together then give the ADM mass. So the masses are larger, but apparently for the areas they can be smaller. And this theorem has been proven for time-symmetric initial data that puts a strict condition on the extrinsic curvature and so on. And one tries to generalize that. And this shows one possible path in which one could do the proof, because we find this connected world tube where you have the individual horizons, then you can traverse the inner mods backwards in time, backwards in coordinate time, and then the outer apparent horizon. And as you move along these lines, the mass is always increasing, never decreasing. So if you can put a bound on the final apparent horizon mass, if you, for example, prove that it is a Kerr black hole, but everybody assumes that, I think it has not been proven yet, and then the mass always decreases as you go backwards in this curve, then you can establish the Penrose inequality. Now, of course, this is not a proof, this is just numerical evidence, but if this holds generically, then this can show a path. It might make sense to try to prove it in this way. There's a tiny problem with that I want to mention. If you look at this plot that you didn't like earlier, this is the mass of the inner horizon. You see that it actually does not always increase. So here, if you go up on the common one, and then here the mass decreases a bit, it's not always increasing. There is a bit of a dip here. And this is probably the weakest part of that presentation here. This dip is related to the initial binding energy of the black holes. We set up two black holes at a finite distance with zero momentum that fall together. They form a bound system. So there's an initial and negative energy there. And if you extrapolate to letting the black hole start at infinity, then this gap vanishes. So that is the story. And the next step for us would be to set up two black holes that have initially a boost, so that the binding energy is positive, so to say. And then we see whether that vanishes again. That hasn't happened yet. I talked about mods. Mods have zero expansion. You also want to look at the region that are away from the mods. You can look at surfaces that have a constant expansion that might be non-zero. And how do I explain this? Well, you can imagine if you look at this blue surface here and have a choose an expansion that's slightly positive, you would find a surface that's slightly larger. If you choose an expansion that's negative, you'd find a surface that's slightly smaller. And we can also trace that in this graph here, which is a bit strange. So here is the expansion that one chooses, and the area of the surface is not the coordinate radius. So this here would be, how does this go? This is the green surface, and this here is the blue surface. And if you make the expansion negative, then you smoothly interpolate between these surfaces. That shows that between the two marginally trapped surfaces, you can't find trapped surfaces with a particular expansion, but the area and expansion might behave in a slightly non-trivial way. And if you look at these surfaces, you might also have numerical evidence which surface exists at what time, that if your black holes are too far apart, the horizons do not exist anymore because things stop to exist. So I don't want to go into too much detail here. It seems a bit technical in hindsight. This is now a movie that I want to show about how the black holes merge. You know the setup, the individual horizons, and so on. I wonder why it starts like this. Let's see how that goes. Yes, you see how things get closer and closer together. This is now zoomed in, right, that the movie is slower. And if you continue, actually see that the green surface continues to exist and has a strange loop structure. Let me try to zoom in here. Well, let me show the movie again, that can never hurt. This is now just slowed down that you can see what happens. And the horizons merge, and then the individual mods actually intersect, and the green surface actually continues to exist. It just has this strange self-intersecting shape. We don't quite understand that shape yet. It is still work in progress. Don't trust that too much. But then this is a green surface which loops like this, goes around, self-intersects again, and goes up here. And this green surface is the smooth continuation of the other green surface. So this has a slightly larger area. So in the plot that you didn't like earlier, you can put that you didn't. I'm sorry, I don't know whether they talk to you, but you're a convenient person to talk to. You give good feedback. Yes. That you didn't like earlier, that we can actually continue that green surface. It's self-intersecting. I don't know what that means, but the area actually goes through there. So it's not an extrapolation, it's an interpolation that seems to work out nicely. And in summary, the new part is here. If you have a binary black hole system, we now understand how the MOTS, the marginally outer-trapped surfaces, look like in that system. They form a connected world tube. You can smoothly go from the two individual horizons initially. They get close together, and they form this common horizon, which you can traverse backwards in time and form the final core black hole in the end. And there's some surprising behavior with the trapped region and the marginal trapped surface in the interior.
You showed this plot where you have this discretization difference, where you have this external circle and these dots.
Yes.
Is there any reason why you need an external surface to distribute the dots?
You want to represent the surface as a scalar function depending on the angles. Mm-hmm. And so it's convenient to have a distance function. Now, this blue function could be anywhere, or you could have just a different coordinate system. Instead of spherical coordinates, you could use, I don't know, hyperbolic, elliptic, bispherical, or something.
Is there a reason why you couldn't tie it to the curve itself?
You mean only on the curve? You need to parameterize that curve somehow. And you want that condition that the expansion is zero, you want to turn that into an elliptic equation for a scalar. So you need to define that surface, you need to define a scalar field that depends on something else, probably on two parameters. And then describing it as a distance, depending on theta phi, that's a good parameterization. That just gives you the ansatz that then turns out to be elliptic that you can solve. How would you represent it?
Well, I was just wondering whether you can also say that you consider the distance, you want to minimize the difference between the distance between the points.
Yes.
That you have an external shape which you use as a reference object.
Oh, yes, you could choose a different discretization where you just move these preference apart that would here correspond to have unequal angles there. But still, if you want to start from the origin and represent it as R of theta and phi, that only works for star-shaped surfaces. And some of the ones we have, that's not the case anymore. So you need to have a more generic representation. And you could store for each point kind of the x, y, z coordinates, but then you have 3 degrees of freedom from the surface, whereas you only have one condition, then you need to make up other two, and that's then less than complicated.
Sorry, I might have missed this. The uptick in the area in the green curve.
Yes.
Did you say it was related to the looped?
No, this has nothing to do with the looping. The looping happens in the green surface here. The size of the uptick is related to, correlates with the initial binding energy of the system. And our presumption is, our hope is, that if you start with binary black holes that have no binding energy initially, then this vanishes. And in an extrapolation, that is true. It's probably the weakest point in our paper, and we're going to strengthen that.
Make sure I understand. All of these curves, green, blue, and they all correspond to different MOTS.
Yes. Yes.
Second thing, you said when the two, whatever we call the two MOTS merge, you say that in the space-time sense, that's a smooth surface?
No, I didn't want to say smooth. So this part here is a kink. So you have the red surface and the green surface that probably also continues, and they intersect here. But that's not smooth. But everywhere else, the curve here is actually smooth. And that kink here, it would not be smooth. So you have kind of two spheres touching, and you can have that as two single spheres, so one surface that it looks like two spheres connected.
I mean, two spheres can touch in such a way that the resulting world sheet, or whatever you want to call it, is smooth in space.
Yes, so it's not smooth.
I don't believe it.
Would be smooth for the event horizon. So I'm just wondering.
Okay. No, for the event horizon, it's also not smooth. If the event horizon forms at some point, you typically get a space-like edge or something there. But the event horizon is null and smooth almost everywhere. And it's similar here. So at this point here, you have a kink, something non-smooth. But everywhere else, the world tube is smooth.
So if you continue, you know, these curves forward in time, does the red then match onto the blue? And
I don't think the red matches on the blue because geometrically they don't meet. The Penrose conjecture says that the red will always need to stay below the blue one. And it's very difficult to look for the red ones further because T2 individual black holes get quite close to each other. And kind of the mods of one black hole begins to push against the singularity there. It can't jump over it. But the surface looks like getting a dimple there. You see it in one of the images that I have here. Sorry, if I can't find it, I won't show it. Maybe you see it here a bit, that the red surface begins to... And I think it's because of the singularity of what happens here in the center.
Any more questions for Eric?
Yeah, so when does the green surface disappear?
It does not seem to disappear.
Oh, okay. Continue.
What happens is that the two black holes, the individual ones, get close to each other, and then we don't have enough numerical resolution there to resolve the surfaces anymore, and then we lose them. Apart from that, there's no indication that they would disappear. And you need quite a bit of resolution there that is a bit expensive. And we're going to try to push it a bit further, but you probably need other tricks, maybe change gauge conditions or something to find out what happens there. Yeah, I'm also interested. Maybe you can find loops and loops and loops and something. Maybe there's a fractal structure developing. Maybe, I don't know, knot theory in the end or something.
Okay, so let's stop there. Thank Eric again.